Slow Burn Media and Bill Huffman present Who Killed? A podcast that provides a voice for the voiceless.
Maureen Boyle covered the highway killings as a reporter and is the author of the book Shallow Graves that chronicles the crime spree.
And they all tend to kill within a comfort zone with an anchor point that could be the killer's home, it could be their place of employment, it could even be a relative's residence.
30 years ago marked the beginning of a reign of terror.
Some detectives wondered if the killer intentionally dumped the bodies outside New Bedford city limits so New Bedford police wouldn't have jurisdiction over the crimes. Nine were found murdered along local highways, two were never found, and the killer was never caught. In the woods, investigators found the remains of nine women between the ages of 19 and 36 years old.
Now, no one has ever been charged for the murders, leaving a cloud of mystery hanging over southeastern Massachusetts for three decades.
Hello and welcome to episode 106 of Who Killed? I am your host, Bill Huffman, and this is a Slow Burn Media production. I've been on a little bit of a hiatus lately from producing new episodes, and I just wanted to let you know that I will return next week with a brand new episode featuring the mysterious disappearance of Cynthia Anderson from Toledo, Ohio in 1981. And I will also be joined by fellow true crime podcaster Naptime Nancy Drew. But in the meantime, I need to conclude the series that I started last week. And I had the pleasure to speak with author Maureen Boyle, who wrote the book Shallow Graves, which is all about the search for the New Bedford highway serial killer. Boyle was a young reporter when a police officer mentioned to her that some of the girls were missing in the New Bedford area. She is now a director of journalism at the Stonehill College in Easton, Massachusetts. You can follow her on Twitter at Maureen E. Boyle 1. Now, she is an incredible resource on this case, and she still vividly recalls the women who suffered these murders. So let's just jump into my conversation with author Maureen Boyle.
I'm very lucky to have you. I appreciate you joining me.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. And thank you for spreading word about this case.
That's one thing that I have noticed. So I've started in the true crime podcasting thing about 2 years ago. I've been a producer at some of the local news stations here in Cleveland. And one of the cases that I did originally was about Amy Mihaljevic, and that happened in 1989. And when I was researching her case...
Is that the girl who disappeared from a mall?
Yeah. So she disappeared from the plaza from Bay Village. And I grew up, we were the same age, and she actually was about 3 miles from where I lived. So it was something that I grew up with. And that was what my first podcast series was actually about. But during the research, I came across the New Bedford Highway serial killer investigation. And I was, to be honest with you, shocked that I didn't know more about it. And I feel like that's just a shame.
Yeah. And there's a reason why. There's a reason why a lot of people don't know about the case other than those that are in New England. And part of it has to do with the time in 88, 89, and even 1990. Mm-hmm. The internet was fairly new to the general public so that you didn't have people on Facebook. You know, you didn't have social media. You didn't have Twitter. You didn't have, you know, that immediacy of, yes, this is going on. That wasn't around then. People were relying on their local newspapers, their local television stations, and the network news. And while the case was on a couple of network programs, but not like you might see today.
I was going to ask you about that as far as what the national coverage was. Did they originally, because I read on the blog, you know, or on your website, you know, you talk about, and a lot of these cases, hindsight's 20/20. You know, you don't know the bodies are piling up until it's too late. In a lot of these cases, like you said, it's the era that it was in also. The fact that they were sex workers too, I think.
So I step back a bit about them being sex workers.
Okay.
There were a few of the victims had a record for prostitution arrest.
Okay.
But these were not sex workers. And even that term workers, I really find misleading. That gives the impression that somehow women are making money and sustaining themselves through sex.
Correct.
And that is not the case here. That is not the case here at all. This is a case of women who were addicted to heroin and cocaine and were out and about in the city. Now, perhaps they were in situations where they were very vulnerable. And a couple of them did have records for prostitution, but not all of them. These were not the regular women that were on the street who were very, very desperate for money for drugs. A number of these women had no record for prostitution. And that's something that people seem to forget. And it's something that really annoys, irritates, and hurts the families of these women.
I can see that. And yeah. I appreciate and you clearing that up.
Yeah. And because I had this discussion online with one person who took issue at one of my speaking events that and started going on about how I was disrespecting sex workers. And I had to, and I said to her, that, and I don't know if you quite understood this, but these are not workers. These are not people who are, you know, getting a paycheck at the end of the week, that they get overtime, that they're, you know, clocking in and out. In this particular case, the unifying factor in all of the cases is the drugs. And this was a period of time where no one was talking about heroin addiction like they are today. Families were very, very embarrassed when their loved ones were addicted and they didn't know where to turn for help. There was not an awful lot of treatment options as there are today for particularly women to overcome their addiction, and especially if they didn't have good insurance. So that was really the key factor in all of this. You had a period of time where you've had a number of people who are addicted to heroin. No one was talking about it. I mean, there were some groups in New Bedford, of course, that were very, very focused on finding what they called treatment on demand, being able to get people help right away. But it really didn't exist at that time. So you had women who were addicted. Their parents didn't know what to do. Their brothers and sisters didn't know what to do. And they were also very embarrassed because no one was talking about addiction at that time. As a result of their addictions, women in particular could wind up in very precarious situations and around people who could do them harm. That doesn't mean that they were selling themselves, so to speak, on the street, and that's how they met their demise, because there were a number of other women who were out there all the time who had long records of prostitution and were alive for years later. So I really believe it is more the addiction element here than the prostitution narrative that a lot of people throw out there as it being very, it's simplistic. It's a way to say, well, you see, they were in this situation and of course this happened. And that's really not the right way to look at it. Women were out there, perhaps in very dangerous situations because of the disease of heroin addiction. So I just wanted to make that point very, very clear.
I think that is very important for the listeners to know that, you know, because a lot of these cases do get kind of bogged down by what the public perception is. And if the public perceives it to be something that it's not, and it needs to be cleared up, especially since we're in a day and age where we can do that. And you've obviously gone about it with your book and doing all your presentations, your podcasts, your talks. I mean, all the things that you've been involved with, you know, you're getting the word out there now much more than I can imagine it was in 1989. I was only a 10-year-old or 11-year-old kid at the time. So I do recall the big thing being crack and the big thing being say no to drugs and cocaine. But you're right. They never talked about heroin. And I never saw it. I mean, I never heard about it. It just didn't seem to exist.
Yeah. In the greater New Bedford area and in Massachusetts, while there was a lot of discussion where you were concerning crack, in this area, crack, at least in New Bedford, in the New Bedford area, really did not take hold. It was primarily coke, regular coke, and heroin, which was interesting. It was, while other parts of the country were really dealing with crack, that was not the situation in New Bedford. It was heroin. What was interesting during this period of time with the women, they didn't all disappear all at once, and they weren't reported missing all at once. And because they were adults, and during that period of time, things weren't computerized, their disappearances in many ways, well, they did fall through the cracks. One woman was reported in Fall River, and a couple of women were never reported missing. Some of the women were reported weeks after they went missing. There was only about two who were reported very, very quickly, you know, within a few days. But so there wasn't this, oh my God, you know, Jane Doe didn't show up for work today and she's not in her apartment and oh my God, what's going on here? There wasn't that alarm was not sounded in many of these cases right away. And a couple of them there were, and family members went out looking for them, not realizing until, you know, months and months and months later that they, while they were looking for the person, they were most likely were already dead.
Yeah, I think that that's the one thing that's unfortunate when you have a serial offender like this. You kind of are waiting for them to slip up. And what I was going to ask you before is, what was the what are the demographics like in New Bedford? I read that it's a fishing town. It's a beautiful town. And just give the listener a little bit of an idea of what the town was like in 1988.
In 1988, and to a certain extent still today, primarily Catholic. It is a large Portuguese population, Portuguese and Irish and French. Most people can trace their route to another country. There are a number of immigrants, first or second generation. You will often hear people speaking Portuguese in the city. There's great restaurants. It is, primary industry is the fishing fleet, which is a very, very difficult job, to say the least.
I was going to ask you if you thought that could be one of the driving factors behind some of the drugs, the cocaine and the heroin, as far as like self-medicating and keeping yourself going.
That's a very touchy subject on the waterfront and in the fishing industry. While there are some individuals who are on boats and are using drugs, a large number of people are not. So that those that are fishermen in the city don't want to be portrayed with this, you know, broad brush that, oh, everyone who's out to sea is using drugs to keep going. They do have to stay alert out there, but not everyone is out there using drugs to stay awake. I think that's a minority of the population.
Yeah, I wasn't trying to paint a broad stroke across the industry or anything like that. I was just referencing the amount of wear and tear on the body and just not having access to proper, you know, even medical care at, you know, on some of those boats, not necessarily getting even like the workers we talked or the work we talked about before. Some of them don't come with benefits. So
very, very, very true. I'd say that the fishing industry, it is very, very rough. You know, people are out there for, you know, weeks on end, and then they're back home for a period of time. So it is a very intense industry, very focused.
Do majority of the fishermen stay there all year round?
Yes. Okay. There are some fishermen that come up from fishermen who come up from Florida, often during the summer months. And they did look at that as any of the fishermen who are coming up from Florida as possible suspect. You know, they examined that theory. But most of the fishermen are local.
Okay. Yeah, I was wondering if they're involved with that.
Yeah. Yeah. The community of New Bedford is very rich in history. It was part of the Underground Railroad for slaves that were fleeing north for freedom. Many of the same buildings that existed way back when are still there. The city's done a very good job in the historic district of trying to recreate what was there while keeping the buildings alive with new purposes and restaurants and things like that. I like to call that New Bedford and the surrounding area sort of the hidden treasure of Massachusetts. People keep on, you know, they say, oh, that's a terrible, terrible place. I say, oh, yeah, keep saying that so it remains affordable, but it really is a hidden treasure.
We vacation up in Michigan, in northern Michigan, and literally there's no stoplight in the town, and I'd rather have nobody know where that is because it is the most beautiful place, and it is one of those. I love towns that are able to take that history of what they're known for and able to utilize what architecture is still there, because I think that's what really brings out the personality in a city, especially in New Bedford.
And New Bedford is primarily working class, very much a working class community. Today, there's a vibrant arts community also. But then working class, hardworking people, a very family oriented, very close-knit community where people know each other. And that's What I think was very frightening about this case is that because it's such a small community, even though it's a city, that someone could do something like that and no one knows who it is.
That is scary.
Yeah, this isn't New York. This isn't Cleveland. This isn't L.A. This isn't Dallas. This isn't Miami. It's you know, hometown USA city, New England, where people stay. You know, they're born there. They may move to the suburbs. They may not, but they always have that tie to the city. To think that there is someone that could be behind them in the supermarket, could be next to them at church, could be at the desk to them at work, that it could be someone that they went to grammar school with, that they went to high school with, that may have dated their friend, that may have been friends with their brother or cousin. That's what I think it unnerves people to this day.
Yeah, I think not knowing is one of the driving forces behind the reason why I cover the cases that I cover, because I think that, I mean, the case that I covered in originally, that case is still 30 years unsolved. And it's just, there's only 15,000 people in that city and 20,000 in the city that I live in. It's just like, yeah, the feeling of having somebody behind you at the grocery store coaching your kid's soccer team or being the high school teacher or this, that, or the other. Yeah, I mean, it is very frightening. How old were you when you first started covering this case?
I was a reporter at the Standard Times. So I was in my 20s. The Standard Times is the daily newspaper in New Bedford, and I was a reporter there for, and I stayed there a number of years after that before going to another paper. But I was primarily the police reporter for the Standard Times for much of my time there. And that's how I found out about this case and the links between the possible links between the women, and particularly the links, possible links with missing persons. There had been a couple when the first bodies were found. First one was found on a weekend. The weekend reporter did a short, very short piece on it. It really did not create a lot, stir up a lot of attention. Part of the reason was that there had been this tragic drowning in New Bedford for the 4th of July weekend, where a mother and her child drowned in the harbor watching the fireworks. Oh, so shit. A lot of the media attention was on that, not a body that was found, remains found on a highway with no name and, you know, nothing to report on at that point. Other than this is what they found.
Yeah, Jane Doe.
You got it. And, you know, there was no ID, there was no wallet, there was no license, there was nothing at that point.
Yeah, there wasn't really much you could go on at that point at all.
Yeah, and then a couple of weeks later, a second body was found along another highway nearby, right outside of New Bedford. And that again was on a weekend. And that was in the same weekend of a major bike race in the city, which also... There was a lot of focus on that. There was a small story on that and a follow-up, does anyone know who these people are, type of thing. Mm-hmm. And no one came forward. And then later on in the summer, one of the detectives had mentioned to me that there had been a number of missing persons, women who had gone missing, that he just didn't feel right about, that they seemed to meet a certain profile, primarily their drug use and where they may have hung out. And I checked the missing persons reports, and there they all were, and they all had the same, you know, characteristics. And we did a piece on missing persons, the women who had gone missing, reported missing, those that we could confirm with the families. There was one woman who was not included on that initial list because I wasn't able to make contact with her family at that time. And then it all broke after that.
So are you technically the one that broke it as far as the connecting the dots, or were the investigators already?
There was a detective by the name of John Dextrader. He is now deceased. He had first began noticing the connection. He was, unfortunately, there wasn't an awful lot that he could have done early on, because the first two bodies were not found in New Bedford. Actually, none of the bodies were found in New Bedford. So technically it wasn't a New Bedford case, but he was a very, very dedicated detective, and he worked very, very hard in convincing the DA's office to take a really hard look at this. And then the bodies started showing up.
I'm just trying to imagine in the 6-month span, of, at least from the research, the first body appears, and then at the end of the day, you end up with the, what, 11 total bodies, or?
No, there was nine. There was 11 women who were reported missing.
Okay, right.
And only 9 bodies have been found. They all went missing between March. They believe all of them went missing between March of 1988 and September of 1988. So there's that very short window there. And the women were found between July of 1988 and April of 1989. So there's sometimes. People think that the killings happened over a 2-year period when it was only that short window, but
that's crazy.
They were discovered into 1989. Yeah, and 2 of the women still remain missing. They have not been found. And that's something that the families really need to know, where these 2 women are. One of them is Christina Montero, and the other one is Marilyn Cardoza Roberts.
Now let's take a moment to hear from this week's sponsors. I've had to deal with my fair share of anxiety and depression in my life, and I'm happy to say that there is now an easy way to get help. Because if there is something that interferes with your happiness or is holding you back from achieving your goals, BetterHelp Online Counseling is there for you. You can now connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment. It's convenient, because it needs to be in our hectic lives. So, go get help on your own time and at your own pace. You can schedule secure video or phone sessions, plus chat and text with your therapist. BetterHelp really is there for you. They have 3,000 U.S. licensed therapists across all 50 states. And guess what? If you aren't happy with your counselor for any reason, you can request a new one at any time. There are even apps available for your computer or smartphone. So whether you're suffering from anxiety, depression, anger, stress, relationship issues, sleeping, trauma, family conflicts, LGBT matters, grief, or self-esteem, they literally have a licensed professional counselor for you. And of course, everything you share is confidential. The best part is, it's a truly affordable option. Who Killed listeners get 10% off their first month with the discount code WHO. So why not get started today? Go to betterhelp.com/WHO. All you have to do is fill out a questionnaire to help them assess your needs and get matched with a counselor you'll love. Again, for 10% off, go to betterhelp.com/WHO.
Do you love true crime podcasts but could do without the chatty banter? Are you intrigued by what's underneath our collective true crime obsession and want to hear field experts, authors, and content creators weigh in on the matter? Well, it might be time for you to kill the small talk and join the dialogue. I'm Rebecca Sebastian, host of Dialogue, a True Crime Conversation. It's a weekly podcast where I speak with fascinating guests from the true crime world and the criminal justice system. Together, we explore the genre itself and attempt to answer the why of true crime and also the question, what are we even talking about when we talk about true crime? Join me every Wednesday for a new episode and a killer conversation. Dialogue is available wherever you listen to podcasts.
All right, we're back.
The families. So the families, you've obviously been in touch with a lot of the families. How do you go about when you're, you know, a young reporter and you're interviewing these families about their unfortunate circumstances, obviously? And I've been there to a degree, but how did you approach it as a young reporter? And
as a police reporter and as a reporter in general, I've interviewed grieving families a lot. Mm-hmm. I did it in New Hampshire. I did it in New Bedford. It was not something that was new to me. And my thinking always has been, and is to this day, that I would rather, there's some reporters who will not interview grieving families. They just can't do it. And that's fine. My feeling is I would rather do it myself and know how to do it and not make it a horrible, horrible experience, or even more horrible than what they are going through. I would rather do it and be sensitive and not make their worst day, week, month even harder. So it's not about me. It's about the family.
That's really good advice for any journalist.
It's not us. It's the people that you report on. It's the people whose stories that you are telling. That's what's important. It's not how I feel. It's how they feel.
Yeah, I try to make sure that I don't emphasize too much about the killer. I try to focus on the victims, and I try to focus on unsolved cases because those are the cases that need resolution. And with this case, it's just shocking that something like this could have gone on in such a short period of time. And, you know, in some of the clips that I was listening to from back in the day, I mean, some of the interviews were kind of crass. I mean, the way that they approached it, it just didn't seem like they were giving it 110% or 100%. I don't know. That was just my perception, but.
And you know, in that, that's good perception. There were some reporters that handled it with, you know, great class. And there were some who were just, I was appalled. I was absolutely appalled seeing how some reporters acted during this period of time, whether it was staking out the school of the daughter of one of the victims. She was in middle school at the time, and there was a camera crew out in front of her school. I mean, there were some things that just everyone was looking for their edge to the story and to move it forward. And forgetting that you're talking about real people. And yeah. There did become this mob mentality because it was, as time went on, there was more and more media attention on the case. Mm-hmm. However, that said, the local media, you know, the Channel 6, 10 and 12, they were very, very tasteful for the most part, because they would be back in the city at another time. Mm-hmm. They weren't just parachuting in. And the reporters for the Boston Globe, John Elliman in particular, he was very, very good with victims and very thoughtful in his reporting, as well as many of his colleagues that he was working with.
Yeah, I read a lot of John's articles, actually. Yeah. And he did approach it very professionally. And that is a shame that the families, like you had mentioned before, I mean, you don't need to make their day any worse than what is already going on. And that's just adding insult to injury if you're suffering through that already. So,
hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's bachelorette bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Got your happy Priceline.
As far as suspects go, was there anybody that had jumped off the page when you were investigating that you thought, oh, this guy, it's got to be him?
That's the problem. There were so many people that you thought this could be him. As I was doing my reporting over the years, there was different times and I would turn to my colleagues and go, ah, they're going to solve it. This is the person. And then, you know, a couple of weeks later, it's like, no, this is the person. Or that's the person. And that really is what makes this case so frightening, is that there were so many people that could have been the killer.
Yeah, the means
and
motive.
When you think of, yeah, and when you think of that, it really is chilling that there'd be so many different people. Because at one point, there was at least a dozen people that were under investigation. And when you think about that, to realize that there were so that many people in your community that could possibly be this killer, I think that unnerved a number of people, and still unnerves people.
Understandably so.
It you know, there's that saying that, you know, don't lift up a rock unless you're prepared to see what's underneath it, because it can be very ugly. And that's what I think everyone discovered when they started looking closely at individuals and thinking, oh my God, I did not realize this person could even be capable of this, or this person could be capable of this. Oh my God, and there's this other person, and there's that other person. And to complicate matters, at that time, a number of people that were in the midst of divorces or breakup, spouses were calling the police, insisting that their spouse or ex-spouse was the killer.
Yeah,
and that complicated matters even more.
Yeah, I've seen that in other investigations as well. It's they put out a sketch or something like that, and somebody's got an axe to grind, and hey, that looks
yes, like, yeah. And then there's the psychics. There was a lot of psychics who came out of the woodwork.
Oh, I bet. Yeah. But 1989 was probably the peak psychic. I mean, peak psychic time, if you really want to think about it. I mean, I can just picture Geraldo and Phil Donahue having, you know, psychics on their shows. And I actually grew up four blocks away from where Phil Donahue grew up. So just a funny thought. His mom lived there all through my childhood. So it was just one of those ironic things.
Yeah. So they did have, as I detail in my book, Shallow Graves, The Hunt for the New Bedford Highway Serial Killer, I detail some of the suspects that they had at the time and why they looked at them. And that's something I think the public has to realize, that they did not just willy-nilly go out there and say, oh, we're going to investigate this person or investigate that person. Number of the people that they, or say all the people that they looked at, there was good reasons for them to look at them. And if they did not do that, they would be derelict in the investigation. And the investigators did get a lot of flack for some of the people that they investigated, saying, oh, this person's being targeted or that person's being targeted, when primarily they were looking at, well, this person looks like a good suspect and let's look further.
Yeah, I guess it really wasn't if you got your name associated with it at the time, it probably wasn't a good way of getting it off of the case.
You got it. You got it. And also during this period of time, this is when, you know, the DNA was really, in law enforcement, was really in infancy. You know, today, if this happened today, it would have been solved. But back then, they needed much larger samples of DNA for testing. The touch DNA was not even thought of by law enforcement at that point, let alone it being introduced into court. They were primarily looking at blood evidence, hairs, and things like that.
Yeah, looking for the old, fingerprints and basic detective stuff.
Yes, yes. And, you know, they were just entering into this new forensic world.
Yeah, it's definitely changed a little bit in the last 3 decades.
Oh, And remember, this was also a period of time when a lot of people did not have cell phones. You know, there was car phones and there was those big bag phones. You didn't have a computer in your pocket, let alone, you know, taking video of people, of surveillance cameras. There weren't, you know, surveillance cameras on every corner. There was, and where there were surveillance cameras, the video was really bad.
Yeah, and most of the times they were just taping over what they had, so the quality was nothing. I mean, good luck zooming in on that picture and getting it played or anything along those lines. Was there one particular, I see that Kenneth Ponte, is it Pont, Ponte or Pont?
It's Pont, Kenneth Pont.
So he obviously seems to occupy a lot of the media attention. Do you feel like he had anything more to do with it than what he did?
I don't know.
I mean, he's dead, obviously. But
yeah. There are some investigators to this day insist that he was the killer. There are other investigators who will say, no way was he the killer. But he did deserve close attention by the district attorney's office and the investigators at that time, because he knew the victims. He left the area about 2 months after the last victim disappeared. He was a heavy cocaine user. Mm. He did not want anyone to know, you know, publicly, because he was an attorney, but that he was having problems. So he was, there was that element to this.
I could see that definitely being a weird element in the 80s, especially, you know, with the heavy use of, at least from a 10-year-old or 11-year-old's mind, and looking back on it nowadays, you know, seeming like cocaine was the drug of the decade. But definitely he seems to fit the bill. And
yes, he did. And when you and I detail this in the book, of how he was very strange, and it is his strangeness and how he reacted with women that really drew the police investigators' attention. He was paranoid. He was weird, and he used a lot of coke. He injected coke. He would have girls on the street buy the coke for him, because he was an attorney, and he did not want to be out there buying it himself.
Wow. Now that's an interesting perspective.
So there was a good reason for investigators to look at him. It wasn't that they just picked him out of the hat.
Doesn't seem like any of these people were picked out of a hat. Does look like they were really thorough as far as what they were looking for. I'm just still just amazed at the fact that the amount of bodies, and nobody still to this day being, and you know, what's going on right now with the case? I mean, anything?
Well, right now, you know, this is a cold case.
Right.
However, it's not a dead case, so to speak. investigators over the years have looked at different evidence, followed up on any tip as forensic science and forensic testing has changed. They've retested material and looked at other ways to perhaps look at the case in through different lenses. And they do have a cold case unit there in the Bristol County DA's office. That's the county prosecutor's office here in Massachusetts. And that's where New Bedford's located, in Bristol County. Mm-hmm. And so it is still very much alive in a certain sense. Do they work on the case every single day for, you know, the next year?
No.
When needed, they do.
Right.
But it's not a hot case like it was in 88, 89, 90, 91. But so, they do look at things over the years.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, because I know that, like, with the case that I originally covered, they kind of, you know, they have a task force that they get grants for, and they're able to do some investigating and whatnot that way. They brought in Phil Torsney, the guy who caught one of the guys.
I've spoken with him. He's a very nice guy.
Very, very,
very
nice
dedicated
guy.
Yes.
And it's ironic. Speaking of Northern Michigan, he lives in like way up there in the middle of nowhere. So he comes down to Cleveland every once in a while and still does investigating for that case, which is really, really.
He is one of the top investigators around. And I think the state's very lucky to have him as part of the renewed in looking at that case again.
Now, was he in? I know that he eventually went to Boston. Did you ever, you had said, you just mentioned that you had actually spoken with him. Did you speak with him about this case?
No, about something else.
Okay. I was just wondering if he had any involvement. Did the FBI have any involvement in this case, or was this just all local jurisdictions?
They did have some involvement because the DA's office reached out to the FBI, reached out to Quantico for assistance in profiling, how to interview people, as well as some forensic analysis of evidence. So the FBI was not the lead in this case. It was a state case, but they did offer help in the case.
I did wonder if they got involved, and if they, you know, I know that they've got certain parameters that they have to follow as far as what they get involved in, what they don't. But I just didn't know if there was like a certain, you know, because the numbers are so high, I didn't know if they were involved more than what I had.
They offered help to the investigators and direction and things like that.
How long did you work on Shallow Graves before you actually went to publish?
Some people could say that I had been working on it for 30 years.
Right.
But, you know, I'd always known I wanted to tell the story of the women in this case, but I had always was waiting for it to be solved. And as the years have gone on, and it became clear that, you know, people were dying, and there's a possibility that it might not be solved, I really did want to have the case documented for future generations so they know exactly what really did happen during that period of time. Because over time, people misremember things, and they misremember the case, even misremembering how many bodies there were, how many, when they were killed, and start interjecting other things, facts into it that just didn't happen. So I started working on it. It was published in 2017, started working on it about 2 years before that.
Okay. Yeah, I think that you've hit the right time to kind of, I mean, I noticed that on your website, you've still got, you're still doing presentations and on the book, and I'm assuming those are mostly on the East Coast, but hopefully this case will get back into the national spotlight. And I know that the local area, as far as the media coverage goes, I mean, when I was researching this case, there was definitely a lot of local coverage, but it's one of those cases.
Yeah.
It seems like you had said, people misremember things, people forget things. Cases kind of blend into other cases. And it's hard to necessarily determine which case is which. And I think that's why a book like yours and the publicity that you do for it, I think, is invaluable to the families that are involved, the victims, and, you know, everybody that's involved. I think it's invaluable. And I'm happy to have a platform, you know, obviously you've been on podcasts before, but I'm happy to provide the platform to get this story out there because it's something that really does need to be solved. And that's 100,000 people in the town. That's a big case to be hanging over your heads. Where do you see it going from here?
Where do I see the case going from here? Hopefully it's solved. That's where I'm hoping that it goes from here.
Have you been able to determine if they have any DNA?
They're not saying.
Okay.
They're not saying whether they have DNA or not, because it is still an open case.
Right.
So that was also one of the challenges in writing the book, because it is an open case, and there's certain information that the police cannot and should not release. There's certain things that, as much as we all want to know about it, certain things only the killer knows.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a reason why that information cannot be released. And I understand that completely.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you on that one.
Yeah. And I tried very, very hard when I was writing this to make sure that I did not include any information that could possibly lead the investigation down a fake road. You know, someone reads something and says, oh, well, I'm going to throw that out there, and they'll think that, you know, I have information when they really don't.
Yes, I've come across that on many cases where people, like you said, interject their own opinions, or they want to be the people that solve the case or get the leg up on the story, like the people sitting outside the school of, you know, one of the victim's children. And that's just poor journalism, and it's definitely not the way a victim's family should be treated. And I think a lot of these cases, people just forget. They get so lost in their own fame and ego, and, you know, like, I mean, it just, being a producer and stuff like that, I think a lot of times you see that, and they make it about them, and it's not about them. It's about the victims, and, you know, what you're doing is great.
Yeah. You can never lose sight of what is the point and the purpose of your reporting, and that is to tell the story of individuals who are not there to tell their story, and to, in some cases, help people either find peace if they ever can, and to find the killer. And, you know, there is no peace until a killer is found. And even then, it's only a partial peace for the families.
Yeah, there's never certain, there's definitely not closure when it comes to a family that loses a child or loses a loved one. There's just no such thing. There may be some sense of relief, but it's still not going to bring their loved one back. And
yeah,
that's a shame. And I'm actually going to be at CrimeCon in Orlando this year, and I'm going to definitely bring your book down to my booth, because I just think this case is just one of those, more people that know about it.
Yep, I agree. That's the most important thing.
I try to make sure that focus on cases that other people may not cover. And that's why when I came across your book and came across you, and literally you're like the number one person about this case. You are the,
thank you.
But it's so great that you put it in print and you put it out there, and you did set the record straight, and you continue to do so. And I think families are probably very appreciative. And
well, it is about them. It is all about them. And that's what's important.
And you're currently a journalism, you're in charge of the journalism department?
No, the journalism program.
Okay.
I teach the journalism program at Stonehill College. That is a Catholic liberal arts college in Easton, Massachusetts. The lovely school.
How far from New Bedford is that?
That is about 45 minutes from New Bedford.
Okay.
And it's south of Boston. You know, technically it would be 45 minutes south of Boston also, but nothing is 45 minutes south of Boston, even if you're in Boston.
Right.
Everything is, it's like trying to get into Manhattan. You can't.
Speaking of that, did you ever have any thoughts that it could be were there any people that commuted on highways that would have been commuting to any major city?
People would be commuting to Providence or up to Boston, north, parts north, Taunton, Brockton, Boston. Now, during that period of time in 1988, there was not as much traffic as there is today. Route 140 in the Freetown area, that was really desolate at that time. And the belief was, and even on 195, where bodies were found on the ramping system, they were very, I don't want to say unique ramping systems, because there's ones just like them everywhere. But it's one of those on-ramp, off-ramp areas that are heavily wooded, so that someone could pull over and do anything over there and no one would notice. And in 1988, that area there, there wasn't a lot of traffic coming on and off those ramps there.
I was just going to say, like you said, if it was today, you know, there'd be cameras that would be cameras of the car entering the highway. There would be so many different surveillance cameras out there that would have captured the killer, or captured the killer's vehicle at least.
Yeah. And many more cars. There's so much more traffic on the highways than there was in 1988, particularly in this area here.
So
the area has grown up.
Do you know what have they said the exact thing that they've used to connect all the victims? Is it certain fibers or?
No, they're not saying that.
Okay. Yeah. A lot of
it has to do with the victimology, mm-hmm. and where they were found and how they were all found in a tight area in a short period of time. You know, they were killed within a relatively short period of time.
And I have just one more question, because I know you are very busy and you've probably got 8 million things to do today. Do you think that there's any possibility that this could have been two people working together, or is this just you think this is one person?
It could be two people. You should never, rule out anything in any case. And there's a possibility that it could be two people.
It just seems like with that quantity and that amount of time, or in that short period of time, that's just the only reason I brought that up. So, but I really appreciate you coming on the show, and thank you so much for sharing this story. And I will continue to promote your book. And again, tell the listeners where they can find your book.
All right. Well, thank you so much. It can be found on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and any of their local bookstores can order it.
And then you also have a website.
Shallow Graves, thebook.com. And there is also on Facebook, Shallow Graves, Hunt for the New Bedford Serial Killer. And people can reach out to me on Twitter. It'd be Maureen E. Boyle, B-O-Y-L-E, 1 on Twitter, or my author page on Facebook. There's another second Facebook page, just simply Shallow Graves. And, we post different information on that. It's an open page, so you just have to click like.
Okay. So people, if they have any information, they can submit information to you if they actually know something?
Yeah, certainly. That would be wonderful. Yes.
Excellent.
All right.
Thank you so much, Maureen. I really do appreciate it. And I hope you have a very safe week and a great day.
All right. And thank you so much for having me on. I greatly appreciate it.
No problem at all.
Thanks.
I love getting attention to important cases like this.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks so much to Maureen Boyle. And thank you guys, the listeners, for tuning in this week. Again, she is the author of the book Shallow Graves. And she goes into great detail about this case. You can find it at Amazon or wherever you find your books. And as I said at the beginning of the show, Maureen Boyle is now the director of the journalism program at Stonehill College in Easton, Massachusetts. You can follow her on Twitter at Maureen E. Boyle 1. As a reminder, I will be dropping new episodes of Who Killed starting again next Friday, wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I will also be dropping a new season of my passion case at some point this spring, so look for new episodes on Tuesdays once that show launches. And if you guys have any information about this case, you're encouraged to call the FBI at 1-800-CALL-FBI. As always, if you enjoy this podcast and my other shows, you can help support them by clicking on the link in the show notes, or you can contribute via the Venmo app with my username at BillHuffman3. And again, that's at Bill-Huffman-3. And I am serious when I say that every little contribution, big or small, helps keep these podcasts running. If it wasn't for you, I would not be able to produce new episodes. Again, you can also support the show by leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Those 5 stars do actually help get the important cases that I cover the spotlight they deserve. And finally, if you'd like to stay up to date on the cases that I have covered, as well as the new shows that I have in the pipeline, please follow me on Twitter at BillHuffman3. Thank you guys again so much for listening. Thank you so much to Maureen Boyle. And until next time, be healthy, and stay safe.
I'm an American vigilante. I have a question for you. What would you do if someone you cared about was abducted, taken from you? Would you call me? Would you care about how I got them back? Download American Vigilante now.
Three AM, the comedy horror podcast that holds weekly gatherings around the campfire. Let me tell you what you're going to get. You're going to hear stories about demonic possessions, prison stabbings, skinwalkers, glitches in the Matrix, cult leaders, missing 411, night marchers, Operation Paperclip, Mesopotamian devil worship, and so many monsters it'll give Kanye West a runaway for his money. Pop and meme culture also aren't off topic. A camp where laughs and scares are constantly competing for first place. We're just a group of friends trying to bust each other's balls, find the best stories, and expand the circle in the process. 3 a.m., the comedy horror podcast, not for the faint or fragile of heart. Let's go.